All right, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Today is November 3rd, 2016. The time is 11:04, and this is the November monthly meeting of the Board of Ethics and Government Accountability. I'm Robert Spagnoletti. I'm chair of the board, and with me today are Carol Schwartz and Norma Hutchison and Shamari Wade, the currently constituted members of the board, although we have a new member of the board who has been apparently approved by the council, although I don't think she's been sworn in yet. Is that right?
That's correct. She was approved on the consent agenda on Tuesday without a hearing.
Okay.
She's awaiting being sworn in by the mayor.
Her name is Tamika Collier.
That's right. She was going to be here today, but I just got an email from her a little while ago that she got caught up in a meeting and hopes to be at the next board meeting.
We'll look forward to seeing her in December. Okay. That would be the full board, full five-member board, which we've never had, by the way. An agenda was posted consistent with the Open Meetings Act, unless there are amendments, anyone? Amendments? No? We'll adopt it by consensus. And we will go ahead and turn to item 4, report from the Office of Open Government. Ms. Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The fiscal year 2018 budget process is well underway. As part of the office's planning for the upcoming fiscal year and to address the proposed expenditures for fiscal year 2017, Director Sobin and I met with Chairman Spagnoletti last week. OOG will prorate the proposed $15,000 octo expenditure to reflect the cost for service for 3 FTEs in OOG. We will also continue to cover the octo expenditures and all other proposed costs, including supporting the BIGA website until the website can be migrated to Octo servers.
And just to update you, I did have communication yesterday with Betsy Cavendish, the Mayor's General Counsel, who was very optimistic about getting that additional money that was required to help us get Octo on board to take over those responsibilities. And she sent me an email this morning saying she's made those communications and will keep me updated on where we are with that. But she seemed to be fairly optimistic, but we can make that happen.
And as planned, the Office of Open Government will go ahead and submit its own enhancement request to cover those additional costs. But it looks like we're far better positioned than we were a month ago.
Excellent.
So thank you very much. The pending enforcement action concerning Open Meetings Act compliance, this regards the Mayor's Advisory Commission on Caribbean Community Affairs. The Office of Open Government agreed to withdraw its motion for a temporary restraining order that would have asked the court to require the commission to stop holding meetings until there was a resolution on the commission's compliance with the OMA. The chair of the commission, via the Office of the Attorney General, voluntarily agreed last week to stop all meetings until the OOG reviews compliance. Additionally, the chair of the commission provided a detailed written reply to our August compliance request. We still intend to pursue issues raised in the complaint, however, and the status hearing for that is scheduled for January 6, 2017.
Okay.
Since the last board meeting, OOG has responded to 23 requests for FOIA advice and 5 requests for OMA advice. And just yesterday, I received another request to field an Open Meetings Act complaint. Finally, trainings. OOG conducted 2 trainings in the last month, a combined MOTA training and a training on FOIA and the Open Meetings Act for the General Counsel and the Legal Fellows at the D.C. Public Charter School Board. That concludes our update. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. I think the ethics side of the agenda is much longer than the open government side of the agenda. So any questions for Ms. Hughes before we move on?
No, but I'd like to just comment on something.
Sure. Oh, I'm sorry.
I just want to thank Ms. Hughes for making that happen with the commission, and I wanted to commend you on it.
You're welcome, certainly.
All right. So let's move on to a report from the Office of Government Ethics.
Okay, so I'm going to try to move a little quickly through the beginning items because we have a couple of attorneys in the room today.
Sure.
So we want to try to get to those issues. Okay, so good morning, everybody. Just to quickly go over our stats, we opened 3 investigations this month. Last month, that was 6, and the month before that was 4. We closed 2 this month. It was 3 last month, 2 in September. We currently have 18 investigations open. That's down from 19 last month and 12 the month before. The investigations that are stayed are still consistent at 20, but after a meeting with the Inspector General's office last week, we expect probably half of those, at least half, to fall off the stayed calendar and to actually become active investigations by us. So we're going to see a big uptick, we think, in the next month.
But hopefully you'll be able to rely on work that they've already done in
that's
those
great.
Matters.
Okay. That's what we're hoping.
That would be the idea.
So item B, publication reporting requirements. We are in compliance with our publication and reporting obligations. We have just completed an opinion, which will be published shortly. I'll mention that when I get to the ethics opinion section. Trainings and outreach. I'm very proud to report that our first annual Ethics Day DC and the Bagus Symposium turned out to be a great success. The 8 hours of course offerings were well attended and based upon surveys, found to be very informative and helpful to those who attended.
And my informal feedback received from a lot of the attorneys and the other folks who attended were very positive. They thought it was terrific.
Good. Well, we're going to make it a tradition now. So the evening symposium brought together stakeholders in the field of contracting and procurement, including Chairman Phil Mendelson, Attorney General Carl Racine, General Counsel to Mayor Betsy Cavendish, and Terry O'Connor, a private practitioner and author on government procurement. The panelists provided useful information with respect to what the board may wish to include in this year's best practices report. And maybe we can take that up in the confidential portion of the session as to when you deliberate on exactly what you want to go in there.
Indeed.
excuse me. The trainings attended by the staff. General Counsel Flowers attended an EEO Counselor Officer certification class on the ADA and FMLA. Conducted by the staff, there were seven, not including the six that we did during Ethics Day. There were two new employee orientations, two MSS trainings, one board and commission training, a training session at the Department of Employment Services, Wage and Hour Division, and an FDS and lobbyist training session. Last month's regular two-hour monthly ethics training session was canceled due to lack of enrollment, perhaps because it was so close to the time that we were doing the Ethics Day program.
Mm-hmm.
I, along with Attorney Chanoon, participated in the D.C. Bar Hatch Act program. I was a panelist. It was designed for government employees, D.C., federal, and military employees. So we had a nice chance to really sit down literally with our counterparts in the federal government, the Office of Special Counsel, and do a nice training. I think it was recorded, and it's available on the D.C. Bar website. Item D, advisory opinions and advice. 42 advice queries since the last meeting. It was down from 68 the previous month. Since the date of the last meeting, we've issued one formal advisory opinion, which I said is going to be published in the DC Register. That'll be next Friday. At issue in that case was whether employees of the Office of Cable Television, Film, Music, and Entertainment, or here's a good acronym, think Bega stuff, OCTFME, could engage in certain statehood-related activities without violating the Code of Conduct. Specifically, their general counsel, Mr. Lawrence Cooper, for the agency, inquired whether OCTFME employees could create and produce media aimed at educating district residents on statehood and the advisory referendum, and broadcast that media, both created by the agency and by others, if done on behalf of elected officials and agencies who actually had duties that related directly to statehood. We advised that the agency employees could engage in such activities. Mr. Lawrence inquired further whether the agency employees could create the aforementioned media to include a Create the State slogan on behalf of the agency. We advised that agency employees could create said media based on the legislation based on the creation legislation for the agency, which required it to actually produce content for the government and education channels. The legislation did not place any limitation on the types of media that the agency could create. Nevertheless, OCTFME employees were required to use funds and resources authorized for that purpose of statehood education and the advisory referendum education in all of those scenarios. We also advised that none of the activities violate the Local Hatch Act, as they were not considered to be political activity. That opinion actually followed on the previous one and expanded on it that we did the month before. We did put a caveat in there, though, that the Office of Campaign Finance had final say over what actually constituted campaign-related activity with respect to prohibition on spending government resources.
Okay.
The opinion's in your Dropbox, and it's on our website. Item E, ethics legislation and the Comprehensive Code of Conduct. The Committee on the Judiciary has asked us to comment on four bills that will be subjects of public hearings on November 16th. Two of the bills would amend provisions of the Campaign Finance Reform Act, which Vega does not enforce, so we've decided not to comment on them. One of the other bills, Bill 21509, would abolish the Office of Campaign Finance and establish in its place a new office within Vega called the Citizens Fair Election Oversight Office. As Chairman Spagnoletti and Mr. Grimaldi learned in the meeting last week, the Office of Campaign Finance and the Board of Elections are opposed to the bill for a number of reasons. For the reasons stated in the draft letter to Councilmember McDuffie that you were sent yesterday, we recommend that the board join in the opposition to this bill. Now, if you want to discuss it?
Yes, and we've actually had an opportunity to at least talk about what the issues that were, and I think that we are in agreement that it would be, currently as the bill is currently drafted, would not be something that we would be able to support taking on the responsibilities of the Office of Campaign Finance without any bodies, money, or readjustment of duties and responsibilities, especially given our current responsibilities and duties between the two offices. We're not in a position to take it up. So I think that the letter, we may tinker with the language before it goes out, but in essence we'll be opposing it in its current form, leaving the possibility open that we would, you know, be happy to look at whatever future legislation might be proposed dealing with the Office of Campaign Finance to the extent it affects us, but we're currently in the current bill. It's not something we could support.
Okay. All right. So, Mr. Grimaldi will finalize that bill and
the letter, and we'll get it out, right?
Okay, that letter. All right. The other bill, Bill 21622, is the one that Attorney General Carl Racine had introduced and discussed at the symposium. Much of the bill, as you know, is addressed to pay to play, but it would also amend the Local Hatch Act to require designated employees to use either annual or unpaid leave when soliciting and receiving political contributions for a principal campaign or an exploratory committee. And it would amend the Comprehensive Merit Personnel Act to require members of districts, boards, and commissions to receive training from Vega at the start of their service. The Comprehensive Code of Conduct that we submitted has related provisions. With respect to the designated employee provision, the Comprehensive Code would limit employees to performing political fundraising activities to unpaid leave only. We believe that that approach is the better approach because it is more restrictive. However, after reading this and after interpreting the law as it is now, as we have been doing, we don't have a strong objection to an employee using their earned annual leave to work on a campaign. They've earned it, which is what we currently allow. Our big concern is that no administrative leave is ever granted for someone to work on a campaign because in that right. case, government resources would then be used for political purposes. We also don't object to the AG's bill that restricts political activity to a principal campaign or exploratory committee or the requirement that the designee file the designation with Vega. The Comprehensive Code really doesn't touch that. And I was trying to figure out what the Attorney General was getting at there by restricting it to principal campaign or exploratory committees. And I guess what we're talking about here is that, you know, they wouldn't be able to work for PACs
right.
or things like that. So it's fine with me. With respect to the ethics training provision, we believe the CCC provision is better because it captures all new covered individuals, not just new members of boards and commissions.
Right. I think that's right. Well, I think that makes sense. I mean, I personally don't have a problem with the use of annual leave. I could see where the admin leave opens the possibility for all kinds of abuse when you are the potential candidate as well as being in a position of granting the leave so you could have your employees work on your campaign. So I think that makes good sense.
Okay. All right. And speaking of the CCC, it is scheduled for markup by the Committee on the Judiciary on November 16th.
Congratulations.
Finally. I plan to attend along with Mr. Flowers and Mr. Grimaldi, and we'll try to get a draft committee print of the bill beforehand. Needless to say, this is exciting, and we'll report on the committee's action as soon as we have news to share.
And have you gotten any sort of feedback about where – I know that you've done your dog and pony show with the council members to get areas of concern, and based on what my recollection is, there were no – you answered questions clearly along the way, but there was no sort of pervasive concern about any of the –
The one thing I kept hearing, it was a common thread with all the council members I met with, was our proposed prohibition on volunteers, and whether, on the nepotism side, whether, volunteers would be considered family members.
Right, right.
Even though we tried to distinguish between someone who was an outright volunteer and someone who was applying for a position of some official recognition.
Right.
Like an internship.
Paying, right.
Right. Those externships, those kinds of things. So I don't know where that's going to come out. Some of the pushback was from members of the council who will not be there in January. but we'll see.
Right. But given the size of the scope of the bill.
Yeah.
There was no sense that there were major concerns about the way that we've approached things, the way we are handling it, the themes that we've addressed. I mean, obviously, we've taken existing legislation and rules and regulations and essentially codified them, cleaned them up, made them consistent, which is what we were tasked to do. But
we also laid, put some of their fears to rest by, in some instances, the
like gift
comprehensive
rules and
code
the rest,
actually,
yeah.
Right, it loosens things up a little right. bit with respect to the inconsistencies and brings them together in a way that we thought
gives clarity.
Right.
Okay, good.
So, but you never know till they all get in a room and they start arguing about it. So we'll see. All right. Rulemaking, Mr. Flowers?
Yes.
Can we have an explanation when you say it loosens things up? Can you just remind us what that might be?
There were a couple of instances where the rules were, so on the gift-giving side, okay, the council had a rule that was much higher than the executive side. And the executive side had a rule that was much tighter than, would traditionally, it's $10. Council side is $50, right, Mr. Grimaldi? And so we tried to strike a balance between what's reasonable and what would be fair. So we increased the $10 one to $20 and brought the $50 one down to $20. So that was sort of a meeting, but on the lower end side of the spectrum.
And we also included a longer list of exclusions within the definition of
prohibited gift, right. Right? Exactly.
It took a lot of stuff right off the table.
Right.
For instance?
I mean, stuff that was
community meetings,
right?
Like that one in particular.
Every freshman at community meetings, or elected officials,
right? For civic and community association.
I mean, and the other thing too is it recognized the bill recognizes now that there are these foundations out there that are designed and created directly to support the district government. Like the Police Foundation, the Library Foundation, the DC School of Law Foundation, and where we have traditionally said that there can't be collaboration with fundraising efforts because it's technically a private entity, we do recognize that these special entities that exist only to support the government, there should be some collaboration that's permitted. And that's the other example.
And the only other thing I would add, not to belabor this, is the one-year cooling-off period. We've ratcheted back to the old days, so to speak,
right.
by providing it only relates to those folks who, by definition, have to file public
financial disclosures, right?
Right. Now it applies to every single person.
It wound up with having many unintended and I think fairly unfair consequences to lower level government employees who would leave the government and then could not get a job in their respective fields because it necessarily dealt with the government they were now prohibited from contacting when no one ever intended those folks to be put in that position. It was really meant for folks who had power, positions of some power, influence, connection, policy, making, that kind of stuff. And those are the folks, by and large, as we decided when we debated this whole thing, who are required to file public financial disclosure statements. So it made sense to use that as the bar. And so we're looking forward to
think of it this way. Imagine an OAG attorney is, you know, an entire swath of potential practices thrown out for a year simply because he or she worked at the Attorney General's office. You know, child support stuff,
DUIs.
DUIs, that kind of stuff, and no one has that rule. Not even the federal government has a rule that would bar somebody from their practice. Sure.
Yeah.
It's been a while since I.
I know. It's been a year and a half since we went through all this stuff.
All right, Mr. Flowers, you want to address the rulemaking portion? He's hard at work.
Okay, we recently submitted to the board proposed changes to 16 sections of the rules. And the remaining, there were 12 sections that were remaining that we had proposed for revisions. I've included two more of those sections in the Dropbox today, but there are 10 that remain, and there may be more. And the reason why I think it's advisable that we not move on those until we know the direction that the council is going to take or receive direction from the board is because many of these provisions would be affected by the CCC. And some of the examples that I've cited here include the provision when public officials are required to amend FDS statements. The current requirement is that you must amend your financial disclosure statement 30 days after changes in any information that's required in the FDS. This resulted in questions being raised as to whether fluctuating stock values required an amendment. And, of course, when you have this type of requirement where there's some vagueness or it's not clear, people sort of just ignore the rule. And that's where we are now. The CCC, on the other hand, I think following the federal model, requires a supplemental statement to be filed within 21 days of the occurrence of any of three specified events, such as discovering that persons listed on the financial disclosure statement have either, well, when I say persons, either these are businesses that you work for, that you receive income from, and that you've either commenced or ceased doing business with the district, so you either have to add new people or you can take them off, or where the employee undertakes previously unreported outside employment. And so we're trying to, I think, target the significant events and make those clear. There's also a need to flesh out the confidential financial disclosure statement filing process, including procedures for appealing designations. And we've seen we haven't really seen it yet, but it may be coming. Right now we have, later on the agenda, these appeals from public financial disclosure statements. Both of these matters, though, in terms of the CFDS and the appeal process, those are addressed in the CCC, and we want to use that as a model and base the rules after this. So there's no point really at this point.
So let it go through markup and then see where they are.
Yeah, let's see.
Right.
And then finally, with respect to the rules governing lobbyists, those have been impacted by recent changes adopted by the council that limit nonprofit status, filing status to 501c3 entities. And then also there are proposed changes to the definitions of actions as to what constitutes lobbying. So it's really very basic. And if those changes are adopted, we'll want those reflected in the rules. So those are a few of the reasons why I think we're not recommending a wholesale adoption of these last few chapters of the rules. And if you look at the changes that are in there, you'll see some of them are just conforming. For example, the Budget Support Act change references from chairman to chairperson. So we'll go through the rules and make that sort of change. So that's sort of where we are now.
Okay. So since the markup is going to happen on November 16th, and let's assume that everything goes well, what would you like us to do? Do you want us to discuss our view of the ones you've already done in the December meeting, or do you want us to wait to get report back from you in the December meeting and then talk about it in January?
The question is whether we want to bifurcate this process, go with the low-hanging fruit first, which are things we know are not going to change, and they're more in the nature of conforming amendments. But then, even if we discuss it in two different parts, you know, I don't know that it serves the public to have these different rulemakings out there. It's probably better to just do one comprehensive rulemaking.
So maybe what we could do is review what you've got already for the December meeting. If we have any questions, we could ask you at the December meeting. We talk about it generally. You can report back on what happens in November. We won't take any action until we sort of see where we are in December.
Okay.
How does that sound?
Yeah, and another big question deals with the spouse reporting requirement for FDS.
Yeah,
and I think we can address that later in the agenda.
And that's going to require, I think, a little bit more of a more extended discussion. I know that we will need to nail it down, you know, in the next meeting or two, so that we can have it in place for when
January 1st
when it goes online. Yeah, it goes online. But I mean, do you want to talk about it now, or do you want to wait later in the agenda? Or
wait till later in the agenda.
Okay.
All right, just quickly on the budget, Director Hughes has already mentioned it. The FY18 budget process has begun. The baseline proposed budget for BEGA from the mayor is $2,062,202. That's $1,912,202 from local funds and $150,000 from our O-type funds. It also includes the existing 15 full-time employee positions for the agency, three of which belong to the Office of Open Government. The maximum allowable request ceiling, or what they're calling the MARC, as it is known, represents a 2% increase from our fiscal year 17 budget. Unfortunately, current projections based upon existing salaries actually leave us short by approximately $25,000. The proposed budget also does not include capital for much-needed infrastructure improvements to our e-filing system, nor does it include an additional FTE to assist with lobbyist and FDS matters. We intend to submit a budget enhancement request by the November 29, 2016 deadline that will include all of these items.
Okay.
Item H, staffing. We will be losing Attorney Cooks to FMLA for 16 weeks starting on November 14th. We are working to hire a temporary attorney to cover her duties during that time period. So if you know of anybody, please have them send me a resume. They've already begun to reach out. Yes, they have to know. They know right out of the gate it's an FMLA position, and it's good for 16 weeks. But still, it might be a good opportunity for folks to, you know, come in and see what we do and get some valuable experience. And
I just wanted to make sure we were getting her back.
We better get her back. When she came in the other day and she said her last day was November 14th, I went into shock. All right. Item I, lobbyist financial disclosure matters. As I mentioned at the last meeting, BEGA has enlisted the assistance of the Office of the Chief Technology Officer to work with BEGA staff to assess our current financial disclosure and lobbyist e-filing systems. The effort focused on review, analysis, and documentation of both systems to include documenting any required enhancements to the applications. These applications support a core function of BEGA's mission-critical operations by statute. The assessment has expanded to include a series of whiteboarding sessions in an effort to find a global IT solution for the agency that would not only cover FDS lobbyist matters, but all of BEGA's processes and functions, such as intake, case tracking, collection, etc. We have had two such whiteboarding sessions already, with another scheduled for tomorrow. Octo has been informed that we need a cost estimate from them no later than November 14th to include in our capital request that I mentioned a minute ago in our enhancement. So they need to get moving on that. Otherwise, we'll be waiting 2 years instead of one. In addition, we plan to migrate the BEGA website from the private vendor to Octo, which will provide hosting, maintenance, and enhancements. And as the chairman said a little while ago, indications are good that the mayor will provide either the funding or the support to get that done. So we'll see what happens there. Next item is lobbyists. We are identifying all lobbyists who still have not paid fines due to their failure to register as lobbyists, failure to file lobbyist activity reports, or those who late registered and or filed their lobbyist activity reports. We'll be sending a letter to each of those lobbyists instructing them to pay their fines and or register and file, whichever is appropriate, and notifying them that if they fail to do so, by December 1st, they're going to be locked out of being able to re-register in January from the e-filing system. So I hope that's motivation enough, including, you know, the fact that we're going to be publishing a list of the delinquent filers on our website. As you're aware, we updated the board last month on the outcome of the July 2016 lobbyist activity report desk review conducted by our auditor, Ms. Alawamne. We have sent inquiry letters to those five entities to ascertain their business relationships with the lobbyists that disclose them as their clients, including how long the affected lobbyists have been working for each of them and when activities and what activities these entities had authorized them to undertake on their behalf. We anticipate responses by November 15th. Again, this is where a lobbyist discloses a client on their lobbyist activity report, but then the client doesn't file their own registration or activity report.
Right.
And so that's how these desk reviews are conducted. In most cases, they come in and they say, mea culpa, I didn't know, and then
right.
they pay their late fees. Financial disclosure, we have an enforcement action, but it's in the confidential portion of the meeting. As for confidential filers, we are starting to try to get a handle on this. Again, we had severe resource shortages on the staff you know, trying to get to these, and so we're finally got a little time now. We're able to focus on it. This was a conflict. It started with a conflict of interest analysis, also performed by Ms. Alawamne, to assist us with the COI or conflict of interest analysis. We requested that the affected agencies provide us with descriptions of matters or projects that the filers worked on and their position descriptions. So far, we haven't seen anything that suggests a code of conduct violation or conflict of interest. There is one matter that we are closely reviewing that may raise an issue. We're in the process of gathering additional information to assist with a more robust analysis. We'll provide you updates as we get them. We'll also be contacting district employees who are designated as confidential filers yet failed to file their financial disclosure statements or filed incomplete financial disclosure statements. Those, of course, are done with the agencies, not with Vega. We will instruct them to file their confidential statements with their agencies, and we'll tell them that if they fail to do so and fail to provide proof to us that they did so, we're going to start administering these $300 fines.
Okay.
We have three waiver requests. Well, just an update. Two of them are the ones that you denied last month and have now ended up in Superior Court, where they filed. That was the Edwin Dockway case and the Charlene Dickens case. We have reached out to the Attorney General's office, who has agreed to provide representation to us. And so I think there's a status hearing or scheduling hearing set for January in both of those cases. We have one other case, Angelani, and that's before us today to consider as a waiver. Mr. Chanoun, I think you're going to pull a chair up.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Ms. Jelani is a program analyst with the Department of Employment Services. She concedes that she makes the statutory minimum to be considered a public filer. Her duties include reviewing and analyzing planning and operations activities of major program areas administered by DOES. As a result, she necessarily develops policies as well as acts in areas of responsibility that may create a conflict of interest or the appearance of a conflict of interest, both of which serve as independent grounds to be determined a public filer, and in fact, her agency head designator as such.
Right.
Accordingly, we request that you deny Ms. Jelani's waiver request.
Has she filed in the past? Do you know?
This was her first time.
This was her first time. Okay. And her explanation for why she thinks she's not required to file is why?
That she has a new supervisor and she thinks her supervisor has mistaken her job duties.
Does she challenge the fact that she does these things?
She hasn't, no.
Okay. She just doesn't think that
she thinks that her designation is in error.
Is it? Okay. All right, for all the reasons we have discussed previously for people in similar positions, I would vote to deny the waiver request. It's clear to me, if she makes a statutory minimum, if she's doing those that policy work, then she clearly qualifies under the statute. And it's not clear to me that the agency made a mistake in designating her. So I would go ahead and vote to deny the waiver request.
I vote to deny as well.
That's being handed up. Before we get to the non-confidential investigations, there is that question that you mentioned a little while ago about the financial disclosure statements and the spousal income question.
Just for the record, the order that I'm about to sign not only denies the waiver request but directs her to file within 20 days. That's Ms. Jelani, by the way. I'm sorry, Mr. Sopin. Go ahead.
Right. I just wanted to revisit the question of the spousal income on the financial disclosure statement form. Just to give the board a little background, this has been consistent since BEGA was created. The confusion came where you would have to report your spouse's job and income, whether they work for the district or have something that comes before the district and they're outside. The question, as it was originally drafted, created some confusion, I think, and some people didn't realize that this actually was a requirement. And so we broke out the question last year to make the question more understandable. And now when it became clear what it is we were asking for, we got a little bit of pushback.
I think that's an understatement. You got a lot of pushback.
Yeah. but not a mass amount, just very vocal amount.
Very vocal. Yeah, some people who were very vocal about it.
The complaint was, listen, my spouse doesn't work for the district, right? She didn't, just by marrying me, she didn't sign up to have to publicly disclose what her or his income is, to the world. And so it's not fair. That was basically what I understood the complaint to be. We weren't going to change our interpretation midstream, so we promised them, those critics, that we would take it up before the next filing season. Next filing season is going to start, well, we're going to open the system up, we hope, on January 1. So we want to get this question settled before then.
Okay, so in all candor, this is me that we're talking about here, right? Because I am a public filer, and so I have to report my husband's not only where he works, but what his salary is.
Yeah, me too.
And so, right, so I will put that out there only because, I've got skin in the game, as it were. I remember when this came up, and we all, as a board, we debated we agreed that we weren't going to change anything midstream because it was not fair to many, many people who had already filed and put that information out there. But then I believe we looked at what the federal government does, and the federal government, the statute is worded slightly differently, I understand, but they don't require the disclosure of the actual salary of the spouse. We are required to disclose where spouse works. Is that right? Or no?
You remember?
We haven't looked at this in a while.
Right.
I don't remember.
Right. So, and I remember very distinctly having this discussion, sort of in one of the public meetings about the fact that, so what additional information do you have when you actually have the amount of a spouse who doesn't work for the district that would affect anything? And we came up with some hypothetical scenarios. I mean, if you're an adjunct professor at GW making, a couple $1,000 teaching a class is one thing, but if you're making $300,000 from GW and you have a matter in which is one of the biggest employers, if not the biggest non-governmental employer in the district, that might make a difference. But the mere fact that you disclose the fact that your spouse works for GW might at least raise the issue with someone who cares to look to see whether there's a conflict and what you do with your job for the district, whether or not it's affecting your spouse and your family in that way. So I guess in the end, I think that it matters where they work. I'm not so sure it matters how much they earn. And it seems to me that in all of the pushback that we got last year, it wasn't that they weren't pushing back about where they were employed. I mean, there might have been a few for security reasons, but not for the same reason.
And, those, and waivers were available to those folks.
Right, right. That had to do with people who were being stalked or identity theft or that kind of stuff,
right,
which we readily grant. But it had more. But the pushback was on the amount of money and the fact that why should you have to give up your privacy interest in how much money you earn from a private employer simply because your spouse works for the district government. And I'm totally sympathetic to that argument. I do think, however, personally, that knowing that they are, knowing where they work, especially when you are in a position that requires you to be a public financial disclosure mm-hmm. person, filer, I think that knowing where your spouse works is a material piece of information that I think, as a practical matter, if you're making policy, if you're giving contracts out, we just went through this whole symposium on this very issue. I think that is a piece of information that is important to avoid the kind of conflicts of interest that the public financial disclosure system was designed to help us identify and avoid. So I think that my view would be that the identity of the employer should be reported, but the amount of money that the person earns, I don't think we should be asking necessarily. We should be consistent with the federal government in that regard.
But we don't know what the federal government does.
We know that they don't require
amounts.
They don't.
They do not.
That we do know for sure.
And the other thing is, there's nothing to if we see something where a spouse is working for a vendor of the district that may raise a question of a conflict of interest, which is what the form is designed to do. There's nothing to stop me from asking what the spouse earns. We're just talking about red flagging at this point.
Yeah. Now, the only, and I sort of agree with what Bob said, but on the other hand, I also, like, I'm thinking of the Harriet Walters case, you know, the person that stole $50 million from the D.C. government and was living, you know, like in Neiman Marcus and everybody, you know, living high on the hog on her salary of maybe, what, $100,000. So I could see sort of maybe categories. I mean, I'm just throwing this out. I mean, we're here on the spot now discussing it, and we've not discussed it before. But I mean, if your salary is less than $100,000, you don't have to report it. If it's there could be categories. They make between
Actually, that's what it is now. It actually used to ask for the actual amount.
Yeah, but now it's category.
We changed it to ranges, and even that they're upset about.
Okay. Well, but you said it was a few vocal people.
Put on the council.
Yeah. Okay. But I'm just thinking about if I would like to know, because if people are living really high on the hog, mm-hmm. and I know their salary is blank amount, and then there's their spouse's salary is in this range, and they're living like the king and queen of England, I might be a little more.
You should always ask. I guess
the question is, should all 3,000 public filers be forced to do that, put that salary information out there, when, if there's a red flag, like you are somebody, you know, we become aware of it, we can always ask what the salary is. The question is, do you post it out, put it up there and post it for the world to see? Which is the concern is, which is, you know, my husband, my wife works for some private company. Why should not that person's salary be out there? If you have a question for me about that might be about a particular conflict, ask me the question. I'll answer it for you.
And you know, in a lot of private, we're not used to this in the government, but in a lot of private companies, it's actually a fireable offense to disclose your salary. Now we're talking about a range again,
yeah.
But still, someone might argue. If you know, you work for a Fortune 500 company and you put down that you make over $500,000 a year, company may get kind of upset at that. But
okay, but the federal government does not ask any range whatsoever.
Not for spouses.
Okay. Well, I raised the one concern I have, but of course you're saying that you can always ask the question, and that certainly
and
helps.
We will, and we do.
And that certainly helps there. Okay, that might take care of my concern.
I have a question. So in this scenario, does that then mean that there would be certain categories of employers that Beagle would identify that would would then precipitate additional questions?
Well, so the information would be publicly available. And so, for example, if it's your contracting officer, but your spouse works for a vendor for the district government, you could then ask and say, you know, what's the salary? What do they do? What's going on? The whole idea is just to be able to know that that's going on. So you could do further inquiry. But publicly posting the person's private salary creates a host of problems for the families, for the employers, for everybody else. And the question is, does it give you any more information that you couldn't otherwise get in circumstances when you might, you could just ask in an investigation, in an inquiry, in a follow-up, and the rest. So, so it's a question like, why you work for the federal government and you don't have to disclose your spouse's salary. You work for the district government and you have to disclose it publicly. When your spouse doesn't work for the government, doesn't deal with the government, doesn't appear before the government, but if they do, if they're vendors, then you can at least follow up. So I guess that's kind of where I come down on this.
Yeah, like my question really goes to how would BGA know if, say, for instance, a vendor's listed and, you know, you do something with procurement, how would the board necessarily know that the company that's identified
does
that kind of work? I mean, is there any other descriptive question that would be proposed? Like, for example, what does the company do? Or,
I mean, at the moment, it would just be the identifier of the employer, right?
Well, not just we have a separate question that asks whether or not
they do work for the district.
Right. But it used to just be that question.
Right.
And now we've expanded, well, the statute expanded it to include, well, it doesn't matter, but also tell us who they work for, whether or not they do business for the district or not.
Right. So you at least know whether they're doing business with the district. Right.
Okay. Board member Hutchison.
I would suggest that we make it consistent.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. So we will get working on that time for the January 1 filing. All right. Now that concludes everything on the public side except for the non-confidential investigations. We have four of them listed.
Okay.
Maybe we could put Alexander at the top just because I know there's representation here.
Sure.
And he's been waiting. And it shouldn't take long at all.
That's fine.
Okay, so we have a proposed negotiated disposition for you in this case, in re Alexander. The negotiated disposition just came in a few minutes ago, so you haven't seen it. So I'll just...
Can you describe it for us?
Describe it quickly for you. It essentially resolves the investigation that we commenced in which you guys formalized and made public. I think it was at the last meeting or the one before that, in which government official was listed as a board member in two private entities, and those items were not disclosed on the financial disclosure statements. The explanation was that the statute was confusing. It wasn't clear that she had actually had to list herself as being involved with these board members on her financial disclosure statement, but has now recognized that she should have done so and has agreed to resolve the matter and pay the late fees involved and to amend the forms. And that's with the negotiated disposition.
Were they paid positions or unpaid positions? Do you know?
Maybe I could ask Mr. Wilmot to.
They're unpaid positions.
Both of them were unpaid?
They're both nonprofit boards.
I thought that was the case. I just wanted to make sure. Great. So it's just an amend paying. It's amending the forms.
It's amending the form for the last 2 years to list those entities and to.
You're absolutely right. Does it include paying the late fees as well?
And paying $600 in late fees,
which is the maximum.
Right.
Is that right?
It's the maximum.
Right. I would vote to approve that.
Okay, but Mr. Chairman, I'd like to just. I'd like to just clarify a little bit, too, that I do think that serving on nonprofit boards don't necessarily have to be written down if you do not get a salary for them. But when you have used your position to advance those boards and when it comes to financially to enrich them. I think that's where the question comes in. And so I wanted to, as we're having this statement here.
You mean in terms of disclosing?
Well,
or in terms of
disclosing as well as directing certain financial monies to those entities is where the problem came in. I don't want to sit here and act like that you can't sit on a board, a nonprofit board.
No, it was a disclosure. It was just a disclosure.
We did not find evidence that money was directed.
Okay.
And so it really the what started out with that kind of inquiry was reduced to just trying to figure out whether or not the financial disclosure statement was accurate. We found out that under the statute it was not, and that's why the case has resolved itself. Because
okay.
even if you're not directing, you still, if you're going to serve not as a member of a board or as a member of some private entity, but actually on the board of the private entity, that's what's got to be reported.
Okay.
And that's what's been agreed to.
Okay. And are we going to make sure that that's also advertised? I'm not talking about this particular case.
Sure. No, we will continue training.
In general, in training, that be part of it.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, yes. Okay. So I would vote to approve the negotiated disposition.
I vote to approve.
I vote to approve.
Mr. Wade, approve.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Wilmot.
Do I need to sign every one of them? Or?
Probably not. It's to your left, Jack. It's the one that's.
I'll also note that payment has already been made, and we can expect the amendment when? It's already been amended?
I think so.
All right. Okay, thank you.
We'll have no doubt it'll happen.
This one? Yeah. There was just another drop behind. Yeah. Do we have an order, or should I do
one? We're not. We just received it just now.
Okay.
I'll sign it since I'm here.
Yeah, yeah.
Do the order.
I'll get you.
Okay. Would you like to do the other two before we get to Mr. Price?
They're quick, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's do those two. Let's just do those real fast.
Okay. Now, next item is In re Adrian Williams. This case involves allegations that a workforce development specialist at the Department of Employment Services offered a client a sexual proposition during a telephone conversation. The board authorized the issuance of a subpoena, and we are in the process of having Mr. Williams served.
Okay.
The next item is In re Hallie Clem. You issued a notice of violation at the October 6, 2016 board meeting.
Right.
Since that time, the parties have entered into a negotiated disposition, which we are seeking the board's approval for.
All right. Could you give us a summary of the terms, please?
Ready?
So Ms. Clem has agreed that she violated the 1 year prohibition with regard 1 year post-employment prohibition by submitting her invoice and communicating regarding a dispute concerning that invoice with her former agency. She also agrees that she improperly sought employment through a prohibited source. She's agreed to pay $2,500 once the board approves the negotiated disposition.
Okay. And what code violations will she be acknowledging?
So DPM 1811.10.
Okay.
And DPM 1800.3J.
Okay. So the 1 year prohibition and then the seeking employment prohibitions.
Correct.
Okay.
We should put on the record here that the 1 year prohibition would apply to her even under the new comprehensive code of conduct, which loosens it because she was so high up.
Okay.
Should a public financial disclosure file.
Okay. All right, $2,500. I think that's in line with what we've done before. I would vote to approve the disposition.
I vote to approve.
I vote to approve.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Shin.
Yeah, good work in that case, actually.
Yeah, that was
a lot of work.
We appreciate the resolution of that. Thank you very much. All right.
Okay.
It's an extra copy, I think. Right? All right, so let's go ahead and move on to Mr. Price's case. So this is in the matter of In re Jaron Price, case 1426-001. Okay. Good morning, Mr. Williams. Good morning, Mr. Price. All right. So we are here today as a continuation of the public hearing that was held on October 13th and 14th, during which we received evidence in response to a notice of violation that the board had issued. There were three counts in that notice of violation, two of which related to directly or indirectly making a hiring decision regarding a position within his own agency with respect to a relative, and one count of failing to file a written recusal. At that hearing, the Office of Government Ethics put on evidence, and Mr. Price put on evidence. It lasted for 2 days, roughly, at the conclusion of which we asked the parties to brief just the issue of sanctions in the event that we found liability on any of the counts, which the parties did do and submitted, and we have those and we've read them. So the way that we're going to proceed today is that the board has already met to deliberate on the underlying counts, the three counts, and we'll announce what we have found. And then I would like to hear your view on sanctions, and then we'll deliberate during the closed session and come back with our final regard. So as you can tell by that opening comment, that means we've found violations. The board has deliberated and found that two of the counts have been proved by substantial evidence. Count one, that is directly or indirectly making a hiring decision regarding a position within its own agency by advancing both directly and indirectly, we have found, the resume of Ms. Ward, his sister-in-law. We also have found count three to be proved by substantial evidence, failing to file a written recusal. Indeed, we found both of those counts by more than substantial evidence. We make no finding on count two. We'll be issuing a written opinion and order that will explain the basis for our findings, and your time to appeal will not run until we've issued those, but we wanted to talk about sanctions before we ever got to that point. The opinion will address count two, but will not make a specific finding of liability under that count for reasons that will be explained in the memorandum. The parties in addressing sanctions have ranged from one extreme to the other, as I will say. And I'm interested in hearing any further comment. You don't have to make any further comments, but if you do have any further comments on this, and in particular, what I'd like to know is what impact the mandatory requirement of repaying Ms. Ward's salary should have on our decision about what, if any, fine to impose on top of that. That being said, we as the board, have no ability to compromise the amount that's due. And I would say that we are going to leave the record open and would be willing to hear, whether it's today or over the course of the next few days in written form, what the amount is of Ms. Ward's salary or the compensation that she received that under the statute Mr. Price will be required to pay. Recognize that we don't have the ability to compromise that amount. The district may, but we don't. So I don't know if OG is prepared to speak on that now, but the record will stay open for whatever amount of time we need in order to get some proof of what that amount is. And if any, there's any appropriate offset, we'd be, of course, willing to hear about that as well. Ms. Cooks, do you have any view of that?
Yes, we have, we have the OPRS documents, which...
That's Pay and
Retirement.
Office
of Pay and Retirement Services. Office of Pay and Retirement Services.
And, right. They handled just that, pay and retirement.
Exactly. So there was notice that Ms. Ward's earnings were being deducted from Mr. Price's salary.
Right.
We actually have the document that was sent to Mr. Price showing that she earned $26,182.10.
Right.
That document was sent to Mr. Price on May 12, 2016. We also have an official notice that is signed by the Director of Human Resources showing that that same amount would be deducted from his salary because that was the amount that she earned as a district government employee.
All right. And so, Mr. Williams, I don't know if you're in a position now to agree to that amount or not, that that is the amount that Ms. Ward got paid, or whether you would need time to independently confirm that?
I need to independently confirm that because my client has stated that he did not receive that May 12, 2016
okay.
correspondence.
All right, so what I would ask...
Actually,
I'm sorry.
Mr. Price sent the document to our office. We have the email with the showing that he sent the attachment to Attorney Pat Sell. So
Master?
He did receive the document.
All right, so let's do this. Is it OG's position that the amount that he will need to be ordered to repay under the statute based on count one? Because the repayment obligation, as we understand it, applies to the nepotism violation, which would be count one, not necessarily count three. And is it your position, Ms. Cooks, and OG's position that the amount that we should be ordering is $26,182.10?
Yes.
Right. Minus any offset that they may have already taken, which we're obviously not in a position to know if they did take any of his money.
They did.
Okay. And
We're challenging that. That was illegal taking.
All right. Well, so, but for our purposes, that whether or not any amount was off, we just need to put in order what the total fine is or what the total amount obligated is. And then if there's been some offset, the same way in a restitution order, you'd be credited for whatever restitution has already been made. That can be made appropriately. But if you would like some time to explore how much was actually taken, we're happy to do that.
Well, we would ask that the board put the entire $26,000
in the order.
Yes, right. In the order.
Okay. I thought that would be the case. All right. So now if I could hear you both.
We would respectfully ask that you not, in light of the fact that monies have already been taken out.
Yeah. So this is what I would say, Mr. Williams,
yes.
Is that if you could by Tuesday or Wednesday of next week, Mr. Gumami?
Okay.
By Wednesday of next week, if you could file something, it could be a letter or an email even to Mr. Grimaldi about what your position is on what, if anything, has been taken out or needs to be offset. Make sure that Ms. Cooks is copied on this so that we can just see whether or not we're all in agreement on this. At the end of the day, if need be, we can just simply order that the total amount be repaid minus any offset. You could take it up with pay and retirement, whatever was taken out rightfully or wrongfully. We just have no control over that. That's the only issue. But what we do have control over is the fine. And so technically speaking, as to counts one and three, each of which carry a potential $5,000 fine, I'd be interested in knowing what your respective positions are on what the board should make of now that you've had a chance to see each other's positions on all of this. I mean, candidly, $26,000 is a big hit for a gentleman who just lost his job. That being said, there are two ethics violations here that led to this whole thing. And we, you know, as a board, really are weighing what needs to be added on there for the various aggravating and mitigating circumstances. And so to the extent that you want to add it, you don't have to. I mean, your papers sort of set out your respective positions, I think, fairly clearly. But to the extent that you want to add anything on, we're happy to hear. We'll take it up in the closed session for a few minutes and then come back in the public portion again and tell you what we think. But, OG?
Yes, so Janet Foster for the record. We would just note for the board's information that restitution is restorative in nature. Fines are punitive in nature. And so we do view these two things differently, and we are asking that you impose fines on top of restitution should you order that. We are not asking for the maximum fine amount per violation as we could, and we do that in recognition of some of the mitigating facts that respondent himself raised in his own sanctions brief. But we would ask that or recommend that should the board impose restitution, it also impose fines for the reasons already stated in our brief.
All right, Mr. Williams.
I'll simply reiterate that I feel that my client has suffered enough. He's in financial crisis. He recently had a newborn baby,
right.
And his family's struggling right now. And so I would ask that whatever the board decides in its infinite wisdom, that it be on the lower side, if anything.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. All right, so what we'll do is we're going to break momentarily. We still have to at least open up for public comment. I'm not sure if there will be any, but go to a closed session, and then we'll come back in a public session following and let you know what we've decided.
Thank you. What time might that be?
Mr. Sobin, how many other matters are there, would you say?
There's six other matters, including some conflict of interest waivers.
Well, let's. How about 12:45? Why don't you come back at 12:45?
Okay.
See where we are.
And would the board like copies of these documents?
Yes, I think we would. This is what Mr. Price sent to Ms. Petzelt?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. So just make sure he has copies of it.
Guys vacating or are we?
I'm sorry?
Yeah, going into your closed session.
Well, let's go ahead and let's, first of all, let's open the board general. It's the time now is 12:11. We generally make available a portion of our meeting time to hear comments from members of the public, anything that's appropriately before the board. I'm not sure if anybody's here who wants to make a public comment, but if somebody would like to, now is the time to do it. Okay, so otherwise we are going to go ahead and I'll entertain a motion to move to an executive non-public session, closed session, to discuss ongoing confidential investigations pursuant to DC Code 2-575B to deliberate on a decision in which the Ethics Board will exercise quasi-judicial functions pursuant to DC Code 2-575B13 and personnel matters pursuant to DC Code 2-575B10. Could I have a motion? Please.
So moved.
Moved and hopefully seconded.
Seconded.
Okay. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Okay. We are go ahead. It is now 12:12. Go off the public record and go to a closed session. So we are back on the public record. The time is 12:52. We're recalling the matter of In re Jaron Price, case number 1426-001. This matter, once again, the board has found that the government proved, Office of Government Ethics proved by substantial evidence two counts of its notice of violation, one of which includes a count what we colloquially refer to as nepotism, but it's really directly or indirectly making a hiring decision regarding a position within his own agency with respect to a relative. Having heard the evidence and the arguments of counsel considering the sanctions brief, the board is going to impose, by statute, it has to impose a restitution piece of $26,182.10, subject to being proved up by, and whatever Mr. Williams submits between now and Wednesday, and on the actual amount. But whatever the amount is that Ms. Ward received that has not already been paid back is the amount that will be contained in the order. And as for an additional fine on each count one and two, the board is going to impose one and three. I'm sorry. The board is going to impose a fine of $1,500 on each count for a total of $3,000. The order that we will issue in the next week or so will reflect or the findings of fact and the memorandum will reflect both of those things. Your appeal rights, Mr. Price, will not start to run until we actually issue that order. And the record will technically stay open for purposes of submitting any further information on the restitution amount required under the statute or that's been paid until Wednesday.
Okay.
All right. And so thank you very much. We appreciate your cooperation and working with each other during the course of this hearing. It made things move along much more expeditiously.
Okay.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you all.
We have two other matters to report out from the closed session as well. In re Yvette Alexander, which is case 1311-002, a negotiated disposition was reached where Ms. Alexander agreed to amend her previous disclosure statements to include service on nonprofit entities that she had served on in previous calendar years and pay the late fee for filing those two disclosure statements late for a total of $600. That will be put on the record. And we have in re Mr. Brown, case 1032-002, is a member of the board in the District of Columbia that is hatched, and he conducted a fundraiser in violation of the Hatch Act and has agreed to pay a $500 fine, acknowledging that he was not supposed to conduct the fundraiser on behalf of a candidate for public office, and has negotiated a disposition, and that will be publicized as well on the website. Was there anything else that we needed to report out? I don't think so. Right. It would be, he was a member of a board of a public board. The third one hasn't been signed yet, so right. I'm going to wait. Okay. I'll wait till the next meeting to announce that, just in case there's buyer's remorse.
The H. Clem?
We did that during the first.
We did.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. All right. So, anything further?
Jelani?
The order.
Oh, the order.
The denial of the waiver request.
Did we do that in the closed session or the public session? That was the public session because that was a public one.
Yeah. Sorry, apologies.
That's okay.
Okay.
Oh, right. Got it. Ms. Schwartz reminds me, just to put on the public record, that Mr. Brown's negotiated disposition was a fundraiser for a candidate for D.C. office, not national office. All right, anything further?
Nothing from OGE.
Anything further from members of the board?
No.
All right. Well, at 12:57, we are adjourned. Now,
December 8th?
We can move the meeting until December 8th. Maybe Ms. Collier is able to join us on the 8th instead of the 1st. Does that work for your office?
I believe it does. If it doesn't, we won't make it work.
So let's go ahead and do the 8th. We'll hope that works with Ms. Collier, our new board member. We had talked. You wanted to talk about February and March.
I think you had suggested the 9th, correct, Carol?
Of both of those.
It would otherwise be the 2nd.
Yes.
You wanted a week later in both.
They both wind up being
because of 28 days of February.
Yes. Yes.
They both wind up being the 9th, which is fine with me.
Which ones? January and February. 9th?
February and March.
February
and March.
It looks like it would be January 5.
January 5, February 9th, and March 9th.
Right.
Actually, at the next meeting, we need to decide on the schedule for the entire year because that needs to be published in the D.C. Register in January.
Yeah, we could talk about it at the December meeting.
Okay, so right now I have December 8th as the next meeting, right? 11 a.m.
11 a.m., correct.
Okay.
All right.
All right, guys.
Thank you all very much.
Long time no see. It's been a busy month.